Chapter 10. A Warm Welcome. The day grew lighter and warmer as they floated along. After a while, the river rounded a steep shoulder of land that came down upon their left. Under its rocky feet, like an inland cliff, the deepest stream had flowed, lapping and bubbling. Suddenly, the cliff fell away. The shore sank, the trees ended, then Bilbo saw a sight. The lands opened up wide about him, filled with the waters of the river, which broke up and wandered in 100 winding courses, or halted in the marshes and pools dotted with isles on either side. But still a strong water flowed on steadily through the mist. And far away, its dark head in a torn cloud, there loomed the mountain. Its nearest neighbor to the north, east, and the tumbled land that joined to it could not be seen. All alone it rose and looked across the marshes to the forest. The lonely mountain. Bilbo had come far and through many adventures to see it, and now he did not like the look of it, even in the least. As he listened to the talk of the raftmen and pierced together the scraps of information they let fall, he soon realized that he was very fortunate ever to have seen it at all, even from this distance. Dreary as had been his imprisonment, and unpleasant as was his position, to say nothing of the poor dwarves underneath him, still he had been more lucky than he had guessed. The talk was all of the trade that came down and went on the waterways, and the growth of the traffic on the river, and the roads out of the east towards Mirkwood vanished, or fell into disguise, and of the bickerings of the lake men and of the wood elves about the upkeep of the forest river and the care of the banks. Those lands had changed much since the days when the dwarves dwelt in the mountain, days which most people now remembered only as a very shadow tradition. They had changed even in the recent years, and since the last news that Gandalf had them of. Great floods and rains had swollen the waters that flowed east, and there had been an earthquake or two, which some were inclined to attribute to the dragon, alluding to him chiefly with a curse and an ominous nod in the direction of the mountain. The marshes and the bogs had spread wider and wider on either side. Paths had vanished, and many a rider and wanderer, too, if they had tried to find the lost ways across. The elf road through the wood, which the dwarves had followed on the advice of Björn, now came to a doubtful and little useful end at the eastern edge of the forest. Only the river offered any longer a safe way from the skirts of the Mirkwood in the north to the mountain shadow plains beyond. And the river was guarded by the wood elves' king. So you see, Bilbo had come in the end by only road that was any good. It might have been some comfort to Mr. Baggins, shivering on the barrels, if he had known that the news of this had reached Gandalf far away and given him great anxiety, and that he was in fact finishing his other business, which does not come into this tale, and getting ready not to search Thorin and company. But Bilbo did not know it. All he knew was that the river seemed to go on and on and on forever, and he was hungry, and had a nasty cold in the nose, and did not like the way the mountain seemed to frown at him and threaten him as it drew nearer. After a while, however, the river took a more southerly course, and the mountain receded again, and at last, late in the day, the shores grew rocky, the river gathered all its wandering waters together into a deep, rapid flood, and they swept along at a great speed. The sun had set, turning with another sweep towards the east, the forest river rushed into the lake. There it had a wide mouth with stony cliff-like gates at either side, whose feet were piled with shingles. The long lake. Bilbo had never imagined that any water was not the sea could be so big. It was so wide that the opposite shores looked small and far, but it was so long that its northern end, which pointed towards the mountain, could not be seen at all. Only from the map did Bilbo know that a way up there, where the stars of the wane were already twinkling. The running river came down into the lake from the dale, and with the forest river filled with deep waters which might have once been great deep rocky valley. At the southern end, the doubled waters poured out again over high waterfalls and ran hurriedly to unknown lands. In the still evening air, the noise of the falls could be heard like a distant roar. Not far away from the mouth of the river, with a strange town, he heard the elves speak of the king's cellars. It was not built on the shore, though there were a few huts and buildings, but right out of the surface of the lake, projected from the swirl of the entering river by a promontory of rocks which formed a clay calm bay. A great bridge made of wood ran out to where huge piles of forest trees were built a busy wooden town. Not a town of elves, but of men, who dared to still dwell under the shadow of the distant Dragon Mountain. They still throve on the trade that came up the great river from the south, and was carted past the falls to their town. But in the great days of old, when Dale in the north was rich and prosperous, they had been wealthy and powerful, and there had been fleets of boats on the waters, and some were filled with gold, and some were filled with warriors in armor. And there had been wars and deeds which were now only a legend. The rotting piles of a greater town could still be seen along the shores when the waters sank into a drought. But men remembered little of all that, though some still sang songs of their dwarf king under the mountain, Thorir and Thrain of the race of Durin, and of the coming of the dragon and the fall of the lords of Dale. Some sang, too, that Thor and Thrain would come back one day, and gold would flow in the rivers through the mountain gates, and all the land would be filled with a new song and a new laughter. But this pleasant legend did not much affect their daily business. As soon as the raft of barrels came into sight, boats rowed from piles of the town, and voices hailed the rafter steers. Then ropes were cast and oars were pulled, and soon the raft was drawn out of the current of the forest and towed around the high shoulder of the rock into the little bay of Lake Town. There it was moored not far from the shoreward head of the great bridge. Soon men would come up from the south and would take some of the casks away, and others they would fill the goods they had brought to be taken back up the stream to the wood elves' home. In the meanwhile, the barrels were left afloat while the elves of the raft and the boatmen went to feast in Lake Town. They would have been surprised if they had seen what had happened down by the shore after they had gone away. The shades of night had fallen. First of all, a barrel was cut loose by Bilbo and pushed onto the shore and open. Groans came from inside, and out crept a most unhappy dwarf. Wet straw was in his draggled beard. He was so sore and stiff, so bruised and buffeted that he could hardly stand or stumble through the shallow water to lie groaning on the shore. He had famished and savage look, like a dog that had been chained and forgotten in a kennel for a week. It was Thorin, but you could only have told it by his golden chain and by the color of his now dirty and tattered sky-blue hood with tarnished silver tassel. It was some time before he would even be polite to the hobbit. "Well, are you alive or are you dead?" asked Bilbo quite crossly. Perhaps he had forgotten that he had, at last, one good meal more than the dwarves, and also the use of his arms and legs, not to speak of a greater allowance of air, are still in the prison. Are you still in prison, or are you free? If you want food, and if you want to go on with me, this silly adventure, it's yours after all, and not mine. You had better slap your arms and rub your legs and try to get me help with all the others while there's a chance. Thorin, of course, saw sense in this, so after a few more groans he got up and helped the hobbit as best he could. In the darkness, floundering in the cold water, they had a difficulty and very nasty job finding which was the right barrel. Knocking outside and calling only discovered about 6 dwarves that could answer. These were unpacked and helped ashore. They were set there laying and muttering and moaning. They were so soaked and bruised and cramped that they could hardly yet realize their release or be properly thankful for it. Dolan and Balin were 2 of the most unhappy, and it was no good asking them for help. Biffer and Bulfer were less knocked up and drier, and they lay down and would do nothing. Fili and Kili, however, who were young for dwarves, and had also been packed more neatly and plenty of straw into smaller casks, came out more or less smiling, with only a bruise or 2 and stiffness that soon wore off. "I hope I shall never smell the smell of apples again," said Fili. "My tongue was full of it, too. The apples' everlasting smell when you... To smell apples everlastingly when you can scarcely move and are cold and sick with hunger is maddening. I could eat anything in the world, the wide world right now, for hours on end, but not an apple." With the willing help of Fili and Kili, Thorin and Bilbo at last discovered the remainder of the company and got them out. Poor fat Bomber was asleep or senseless. Dori, Nori, Ori, Oin, and Glonin were waterlogged and seemed only half alive. They had all been carried one by one and laid helpless on the shore. "Well, here we are," said Thorin, "and I suppose we ought to thank our stars and Mr. Baggins. I'm not sure he has a right to expect it, though I wish he could have arranged a more comfortable journey. Still, all very much at your service once more, Mr. Baggins. No doubt we shall feel properly grateful when we are fed and recovered. In the meanwhile, what's next?" "I suggest Lake Town," said Bilbo. "What else is there?" Nothing else, of course, could be suggested, so, leaving the others, Thorn, and Feely and Killy and the Hobbit went along the shore to the great bridge. There were guards at the head of it, but they were not keeping very careful watch, for it was so long since they had seen any real need. Except for an occasional squabble about the river trolls, they were friends with the wood elves. Other folk were far away, and some of the younger people in town openly doubted the existence of any dragon in the mountain, and laughed at greybeards and gammers who said that they had seen him flying in the sky in their younger days. That being so, it is not surprising that the guards were drinking and laughing by a fire in their hut, and did not hear the noise of unpacking in the dwarves of the foothills of the four scouts. Their astonishment was enormous when Thorin and Oakenshield stepped in their door. "Who are you and what do you want?" they shouted, leaping to their feet and groping their weapons. "Thorin, son of Freyr, son of Thor, king under the mountain," said the dwarf in a loud voice, and he looked at it in spite of his torn clothes and dragged hood. The gold gleamed on his neck and his waist. His eyes were dark and deep. "I have come back. I wish to see the master of this town." Then there was tremendous excitement. Some of the more foolish ran out of the hut as if they expected the mountain to go golden in the night, all the waters of the lake to run yellow right away. The captain of the guard came forward. "And who are these?" he asked, pointing to Feely and Keely and Bilbo. "The sons of my father's daughter," answered Thorin. "Feely and Keely of the race of Durin, and Mr. Baggins, who has traveled with us to the west." "If you come in peace and lay down your arms," said the captains. "We have none," said Thorin. And it was true enough. Their knives had been taken by the wood elves, and the great sword Orcrist, too. Bilbo had his short sword, hidden as usual, but would not say anything about that. "We have no need of weapons, who return at last to our own as spoken of old, nor could we fight against so many. Take us to your master." "He is at a feast," said the captain. "Then all the more reason for taking us to him," burst in Feely, who was getting impatient at the solemnities. "We are worn and famished after our long road, and we have sick comrades. Now make haste and let us have no more words, for your master may see something in us." "Follow me then," said the captain. With the six men about them, they led them over the bridge to the gates into the marketplace of the town. This was a wide circle of quiet water surrounded by tall piles on which were built greater houses, and the long wooden quays with many steps and ladders going down to the surface of the lake. From one great hall shone many lights, and there came many a voice of sound. They passed its doors and stood blinking in the light, looking at the long tables filled with folk. "I am Thorin, son of Thrain, son of Thor, king under the mountain. I return," cried Thorin in a loud voice before the door, before the captain could say anything. All leapt to their feet. The master of the town, too, sprang from his great chair. But none rose in greater surprise than the raftmen of the elves who were sitting at the lower end of the hall, pressing forward before the master's table. They cried, "These are the prisoners our king have escaped, wandering vagabond dwarves that could not do any good of counting themselves, sneaking through the woods and molesting our people." "Is this true?" asked the master. As a matter of fact, he thought it far more likely than the return of the king under the mountain, if any such person had existed. "It is true that we were wrongfully waylaid by the elven king and imprisoned without cause as we journeyed back to our own land," answered Thorin. "But lock nor bar may hinder our homecoming, spoken of old, nor is the town of wood elves realm. I speak to the master of the town of men of the lake, not to the raftmen of the king." The master then hesitated and looked from one to the other. The elven kind was very powerful in their parts, and the master wished for no enemy with them. Nor did he think much of the songs of old, given his mind to trade and tolls, to carry goes and gold, to which the habit he owed his position. Others were different in mind, however, and quickly the matter was settled without him. The news had spread from the doors of the hall like fire through the town. People were shouting inside the hall and outside it. The quays were thronged with hurrying feet. Some began to sing snatches of old songs concerning the king's return under the mountain, that it was Thor's grandson, not Thor himself, that had come back. It did not bother them at all. Others took up and sang really loud and high over the lake. "King beneath the mountains, the king of carven stone, the lord of silver fountains shall come unto his own. His crown shall be upheld in, his harp shall be restrung. His hall shall echo golden, the songs of yore sung. The wood shall weave on the mountains, and the grass beneath the sun. His wealth shall flow in fountains, and the river's gold shall run. The stream shall run in gladness, the lake shall shine and burn. All sorrow, fail, and sadness at the mountain king's return. So they sang, or very like that, only there was a great deal more of it, and there was much shouting, as well as the music of harps and fiddles mixed in with it. Indeed, such excitement not had been known in the town in memory of the oldest grandfather. The wood elves themselves began to wonder greatly, and even to be afraid. They did not know, of course, how Thorin had escaped, and they began to think the king might have had serious mistake. As for the master, he saw there was nothing else to do but for to obey the general clamor, for the moment at any rate, and pretended to believe that Thorin was what he said. So he gave up his own great chair and set Feely and Keely beside him in place of honor. Even Bilbo was given a seat at the high table, and no exception of where he came in, no songs had alluded to him in the obscurest way, was asked for in the general bustle. Soon afterwards, the other dwarves were brought into the town amidst the scenes of astonishing enthusiasm. They were all doctored and fed and housed and pampered in the most delightful, satisfactory fashion. A large house was given up to Thorin and his company. Boats and rowers, too, were pulled at their service. A crowd sat outside and sang songs, or cheered if any dwarf showed up so much as his nose. Some of the songs were old ones, but some of them were quite new and spoken confidently of the sudden death of the dragon and the cargoes of rich peasants coming down the mountain to the lake. These were inspired largely by the master, and they did not particularly please the dwarves. But in the meantime, they were all contented, and they quickly grew fat and strong again. Indeed, within a week, they were quite recovered, fitted in cloth, of their proper colors, with beards combed and trimmed, and proud steps. Thorin looked and walked as if the kingdom was already regained, and Smaug chopped up into little pieces. Then, as he said, the dwarves' good feeling towards the little hobbit grew stronger every day. There were no more groans or grumbles. They drank to his health, and they patted him on the back, and they made great fuss of him, which was just as well, for he was not feeling particularly cheerful. He had not forgotten the look of the mountain, nor the thought of the dragon, and he had besides a shocking cold. For 3 days he had sneezed and coughed and could not get it out, even though that his speeches at banquets were limited to, "Thank you very much." In the meanwhile, the wood elves had gone back to the forest river with their cargoes, and there was great excitement in the king's palace. I have never heard what happened to the chief of the guards and the butler. Nothing, of course, was ever said about the keys or barrows while the dwarves stayed in Lake Town, and Bilbo was careful to become invisible. Still, I dare say, more was guessed than to know. Though doubtless Mr. Baggins remained a bit of a mystery. In any case, the king now knew of the dwarves' errand, or thought he did, and he said to himself, "Very well, we'll see. No treasure will come back through the Mirk Wood without my having something say in the matter. But I expect they will come to a bad end, and serve them right." He, at any rate, did not believe in dwarves fighting and killing dragons like Smaug, and he strongly suspected attempting burglary or something like it, which shows he was a wise elf and wiser than the men in the town, though not quite right, as we shall see in the end. He sent out our spies about the shores of the lake and as far northwards as the mountain as they would go, and waited. At the end of a fortnight, Thorin began to think of his departure. While the enthusiasm still lasted in the town was a great help to them, it would not do to let everything cool down without delay. So he spoke to the master and his counselors and said that he and his company must soon go towards the mountain. Then, for the first time, the master was surprised and a little frightened. He wondered if Thorin was at all really a decent descendant of the old kings. He had never thought that the dwarves would actually dare to approach Smaug, but believed that they were frauds who would sooner or later be discovered and turned out. He was wrong. Thorin, of course, was really the grandson of the king under the mountain, and there is no knowing what a dwarf will dare and dare not do for revenge or the recovery of his own. But the master was not sorry at all to let them go. They were expensive to keep, and their arrival had tidings turned into a long holiday in which business was at a standstill. Let them go and bother Smaug and see if he welcomes them now, he thought. Certainly, Thor's son, or whatever you said, you must claim your own. The hour is at hand, spoken of old. What help can we offer shall be yours, and we trust to your gratitude when your kingdom is regained. So one day, although autumn was now getting far on, and winds were cold, and leaves were falling fast, Three large boats left Lake Town laden with rowers, dwarves, Mr. Baggin, and many provisions. Horses and ponies had been sent around circulation paths to meet them at their appointed landing. The master and his counselors bade them farewell from the great steps of the mountain hall that went down to the lake. People sang on the quays and out of the windows. The white oars dipped and splashed off as they went north up the lake, and on the last stage of their journey, the only person thoroughly unhappy was Bilbo.